this week on Capitalism, Race, and Democracy.
We at war. Yes. You know, and at war was not something we declared ourselves. Mm-hmm. It was a war declared against us, and we decided we got to try to survive it. So that's what happened.
We hear from Baranza Bowers Jr., a veteran member of the Black Panther Party and political prisoner released in May 2024 after being caged for 51 years.
They would do little things like that to disrupt, you know, our family. And I knew that that would trigger my dad, because if he saw me crying, he would be upset.
Kisise Siddiqui, daughter of political prisoner Kamal Siddiqui, recalls what it was like being the child of revolutionary parents and being harassed by the FBI's counterintelligence program.
Man is still standing on his innocence.
Jamal Ibn Mumia, the son of internationally known journalist, author, and political prisoner Mumia Abu-Jamal, highlights the contradictions surrounding his father being held captive for 43 years.
There has been a kind of ideological advance by imperialists to obscure, if not obliterate, some of the discourses that the Panthers and other Black radicals and Black revolutionaries were involved in.
Scholar activist Dr. Gerald Horn talks about his new book, Armed Struggle, Panthers and Communists, Black Nationalists and Liberals in Southern California through the 60s and 70s. From Pacifica Radio, this is Capitalism, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from Pacifica stations and affiliates across the U.S. I'm your host, Akua Holt. October is Black Panther Awareness Month. It's a time to reflect on the history of the Black Panther Party and to share the stories from the courageous Panthers who dared to fight a system of white supremacy for justice and equality. For more on the Black Panthers' history, legacy, and network resources, visit bbpaln.org. Also, check out It's About Time, BPP.com. Baranza Bowers Jr., a veteran member of the Black Panther Party, was incarcerated for over 51 years at the Federal Medical Center in Butner, North Carolina. Bowers became a role model, an author, musician, and healer with a strong interest in Buddhist meditation and Native American spirituality while serving a lengthy sentence. In 1973, Bowers was convicted of murder based solely on testimony from government informants who received reduced sentences. One of the informants was reportedly paid $10,000. There was no physical evidence or eyewitnesses linking Bowers to the crime. Despite maintaining his innocence for decades, his parole appeals were denied, as admission of guilt is usually required for release. Bowers was finally released in May of 2024. He says it weighed heavily on him to be sidelined as an activist during that time. However, he was able to transcend prison walls by embracing an opportunity to grow. He is attorney and WPFW host Nkechi Taifa in conversation with Baranza Bowers Jr.
So, Baranza, it's just so exhilarating to actually meet you in person. I consider you a living legend. You know, you've been through so much, 51 years in the belly of the beast, coming out strong and magnetic and all of the above. You know, how did you do it? How did you survive 51 years?
You know what? For real, and Kishi, a lot of people asked me that while I was down. How do you manage to maintain a good spirit, a positive spirit, in spite of the circumstances around you? And say, some of the youngsters say, man, how do you do all that time? First thing I say is, obviously, you have to keep breathing. Keep breathing. And keeping breathing in a place like I've been wasn't always very easy. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's very difficult. But I managed to keep breathing. Mm-hmm. So then the other question is, that's a given, you're breathing. So how do you maintain your dignity, self-respect, respecting other people? Mm-hmm. And I remember reading one of Nelson Mandela's books. He said, one of the most difficult things that he and his comrades found to do during that time in South Africa was how not to adjust. And so when you look at that and say, how not to adjust, what do you mean? So obviously he didn't mean you're in a state of constant rebellion because you're in the belly of the beast. Mm-hmm. So I figured it out that you got to, on a daily basis, do something that's not ordered for you to be done by the authorities. Do something on your own volition. So you can say, for instance, they call chow. You don't have to go to chow just because they call it. When they say lock you in the cell, you don't have to go to sleep just because you got in. They open the door, you don't have to come out just because they open the door. You got to find some way to find independence yourself. And sometimes you just say, well, God say, do this. I'm not doing that, man. You do it. You know what I mean? So you suffer the consequences. They lock you up in a hole. But you're already locked up, so it doesn't matter where you're in the hole or in the compound. It matters, but it don't matter. So you have to find a way to balance those things. And I found a way to balance them by meditation, exercise. And one of the most important things is to stay in touch with the outside world, not just family and friends, but the outside world that's swirling around you. You got to stay in touch with that outside world as well as the inside world. Overemphasize one to the denial of the other, then you get one-sided. And so I was able to observe people who were one-sided, like a lot of the guys in prison, but that they shut the outside world out. I said, man, I don't have time for that. Then I saw how one-sided they get. Then I saw those who just lived it on the phone, writing letters, da-da-da, and then not paying attention to what's going on inside. So I determined early on not to get caught up in either side like that, to be one-sided, narrow-minded, but to try to stay focused broadly as well as narrowly. It's a balancing act, but it's not an act. It's a way of life. You gotta determine.
It's a way of life.
Yeah. Uh-huh. You gotta determine, what are you gonna do? I had a life sentence coming in. What are you gonna do? I don't intend to spend the rest of my life in prison. You never know. Some guys do and some guys don't. But I always tell every guy to come in, you don't know how long you're gonna be in. Everyone who comes in has a life sentence. You gotta do it with some type of self-respect and dignity, man. You just can't just kowtow and just be this groveling for a respite from the pain of imprisonment, from being away from your loved ones and family. That's a 24-hour type of pain that just 24/7 that stays with you. But you can't dwell on that either. You just gotta, like Tupac said, you gotta be a rose growing in concrete. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Or Sardis Cure said, you have to be able to listen to the grass grow.
Yes, yeah.
You can watch it grow and you can listen to it. So all those kind of things that seem to be intangible, they really are intangible. But, but at the same time, you have to deal with those things on the so-called intangible level, but you got to be ever.
So let me ask you this. You talk about being aware of surroundings. I know early on in your incarceration, unjust, I might add, Brother Imari Abubakari Obadeli was in the federal facility with you. I know you told me a story about how you unobtrusively was seeking to protect him there. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, Imari Obadeli, he was a very special guy. And so when he came in and I'd heard about him, and I'm observing him without him observing me, That's how we do it. You know, we don't just come up, hey, man, how you doing? Mm-hmm. So after a while, I could feel his spirit. Mm-hmm. And he has a very strong spirit. But I also recognize that he wasn't fully aware of his importance to our movement. And I found out he was the president of the Republic of New Africa. Mm-hmm. He had a vice president named Chakwe Lumumba. So now I convinced some of the brothers to get a job where he working at. Doing the little butter thing
in the kitchen,
mess hall, in food service, so he could watch him. And Sam and other brothers were watching when he was walking the track. Mm-hmm. You know how you're strolling, like you're contemplating whatever you're contemplating, the things you're thinking about. Mm-hmm. And so one day he came, and we had a nice crew. I won't mention her name, but we had a nice crew. And so we were meeting in the library. So he came up here and he saw us. Hey, Brother Mari, come over and sit down, man. He came and sat down with us. And so he looking around, introduced all the comrades. But so he said, oh, I saw you working the same job I work at, huh? He said, yes, sir.
Kitchen.
And so the other brother, I see you on the track. Joe, he's behind me. You never come up. He said, yes, sir. Then I broke it down to him. Was why? It's important for us to protect you while you are here. We're in Atlanta, Georgia, man. And we got a lot of racists down here. And they would love to be able to kill you. And so we have to make sure we protect you. That's why the brothers have been protecting you without you knowing it. And he was taken aback. And he said, wow, I never thought about that. So I said, yeah, that's what we're here for. We think about those kind of things because we know we're at war.
Yes.
You know, and that war was not something we declared ourselves. Mm-hmm. It was a war declared against us, and we decided we got to try to survive it. So that's what happened.
So let's fast forward up to Black Panther Party. Yeah, so you were involved with the party for a while.
Yeah, because, all right, growing up with that type of environment in poverty, I'm talking about poverty at a high level. For instance, when that people go to welfare in Oklahoma, McAllister, my mother went on welfare because my daddy was in the Army. So, mm-hmm. But all of her sisters, she had five sisters, they were all on welfare, three of them. Mm-hmm. One of them wasn't because her husband was working the railroad. Anyway, so it's so hot summertime. I'm talking about scorching hot. So we walking around with a little bitty BBD shorts, underwear on, no shirt, sometimes a t-shirt. We running around. So the people in the community would take us with them to pick up welfare. Welfare like cheese and mm-hmm. powdered milk and beans and bread and all kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Anyway, when you get out there, I'm looking around. We all little. I'm looking around. I see where we are. It's hot sun. So women would be sitting in the car, fanning like they in church with the fan, mm-hmm. little paper fan. But the white folks over here, they under a awning, tin awning, where mm-hmm. they can be in the little shade. Mm-hmm. So we'd have to get in line for the old folks because the sun don't bother us. We're out there chilling for real. So when they time come, then they come in and get their stuff and we leave. But I'm looking at that relationship and wondering, what the hell? So when I heard about the Black Panther Party, I was in Omaha, Nebraska. I sent a guy out to Oakland to let him know that we want to establish a Black Panther Party chapter in Omaha, Nebraska. Mm-hmm. We went out there and got permission, came back. So I was captain, co-captain. So then Elder Cleaver and Captain Lean and Captain Crutch and a few of them, I heard they were going to be at a Peace and Freedom Convention in Ann Arbor, Michigan. So we drove up there. We already got a chapter set up. We drove up there and met Eldridge and Kathleen and them. And I told Eldridge, I asked him to come back through Omaha and give a speech in the park, and I'll have security set up for you real good.
Mm-hmm.
He said, okay. So I set up security real good, picked him up at the airport. And he's coming out the plane. He's at the airport walking out. He's playing a song in his tape recorder by Bob Dylan about Mr. Jones. Something is happening. You don't know what it is, do you, Mr. Jones? And he's walking. He's tall and got on his blue shirt and black leather jacket. Kathleen with a big bush and all that. And so he came in and gave the speech. And so that made a really official announcement that the Black Panthers are here in Omaha, Nebraska. That's how we did it. But come to find out later on, and teach you that the guy who was co-captain of the party, he was working with the Popo the whole while.
Oh, mm-hmm.
I found out from his girlfriend.
Mm-hmm. And all this was part of the FBI's one secret COINTELPRO kind of.
And we had no idea.
Program.
We had no idea about it.
Dirty tricks. All the things. War. It was war. The Senate Church Committee that investigated the COINTELPRO characterized it as a war against Black people. Yeah. I mean, you know, that's what it was. And, you know, not one of those FBI agents ever went to prison for COINTELPRO.
And that came out with that church report in 1976.
Right.
And nothing ever happened.
Who gonna pay reparations on my soul? That's what I just keep saying.
Yep.
That was former Black Panther Party political prisoner, Baranza Bowers Jr., speaking to attorney Nkechi Taifa, host of Human Rights and Justice Radio on Pacifica's WPFW in the nation's capital. You can follow him on Instagram at Baranza Bowers. That's B-E-R-O-N-Z-A-B-O-W-E-R-S. Veronica Bowers Jr. to touch the spirit. You're listening to Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm your host, Akua Holt. Kasise Siddiqui is the daughter of political prisoner Kamal Siddiqui. Speaking to J.R. Valray, she recalls what it was like being the child of revolutionary parents and being harassed by the FBI's counterintelligence program at a very young age. She talks about her life being mentioned in the classic revolutionary book, Asada, which is written by political exile Asada Shakur, who is also the mother of her sister.
Your hero is his mom, Hattie Hilton, my grandmother. So I think my father, again, he said he was born to be a revolutionary. He met my mom in, I think, 1969, too. And my father met my mom on Guy Brewer Avenue in Queens. And it's interesting because my parents initially, just from the moment that they met, I say in my play, I have a play, I said there was revolutionary chemistry between them. He loved my mother's fiery feistiness. And when both of them joined the party, they were led by another Panther who passed away, John Thomas. And so again, a lot of the Panthers, you know, they were on the ground. My parents being very young, my mother was 16 when she joined the party and my father was 18 or maybe 17. You know, they were on the ground. They got up every morning. They were in the communities. They made sure that they, you know, a part of the breakfast program and sold the Black Panther papers. They were dedicated Panthers. And in that time, they created me. So I was born in 1971. So I had very young parents. And so, yeah, my father was in the party for quite some time. And then he was arrested when he was in 1971. I didn't meet my father until 9 months. And then my mom has jokes about my father, too, is that there were other Panthers who knew me more so than my father. But when my father and I met, he took me from my mom and he was determined for us to have a great relationship because I cried when he first held me. I went to everyone, but I didn't want to go to my father. And when I went to my father, he took me out for the day and I came back and I guess I was a little older. This is after 9 months, but I came back and I had I was on his shoulders and I was smiling. And that was the beginning of I say our love, father, daughter, love. And when my father got arrested, he would always write me letters. So he came out in 1979.
You said he used to always write you letters?
Yeah, my dad used to write me a lot of letters. And my mother made sure that my father and I had a relationship. We're very close. She would always take me to see him. I think he was in upstate Sing Sing. I don't remember. I don't recall all the prisons, but my mother wanted me to have as much of a normal life as possible. So even when she would bring me upstate, we'd take a bus, she would stop at the lake first and pack a little lunch for us. And then we'd go visit my father. And she always kind of prepared me. And even in those horrific situations, I always felt the love from my parents. I always felt their connection.
What was your father's case at that time, and how was it explained to you, and what was your experience with the counterintelligence program at that time?
Wow. I was really protected. I think I kind of had two lives in a sense, because at that time, I'm trying to think of my father, I think it was robbery or something. And he also, I guess I could get into it later, was, you know, had a taste with Asada. And I always, I think my mom, kind of separated a lot. Let me just backtrack. So when I was 2 years old, as a toddler, I would go back and forth to court. And I mean, Asada mentions in her book that there was this little girl who screamed when she saw her father being beaten, and that was me. And my grandmother would always tell my mom, you can't really have your daughter exposed to this because it's too much for her. As a toddler, I visited my father in jail. This is before he had a long sentence and he was getting his GED. And I remember going to see him and there being that glass. It was dark. And my mother and I went into a room and we were told that my father was going to come out in a few minutes and he and I will be able to kind of celebrate his receiving his GED. But they didn't let him come, but he didn't come out. And I was we were in this trapped room, in this room, the dark room, for hours and hours and hours. And my mom said I was hysterical. And you know, they would do little things like that to disrupt, you know, our family. And I knew that that would trigger my dad, because if he saw me crying, he would be upset. So, again, as a toddler, my grandmother would always say to my mom, you know, like, again, you can't have your daughter going to courts like this, because it's just, that's a lot for her. So my mom, you know, she was like in the middle, caught in the middle of wanting, again, me to have a relationship with my father, but then also being a parent and making sure that I had as much of a normal life as possible.
Well, you alluded a little bit to the Sada Shakur book and you being in it. Can you talk a little bit about why did you bring that up? And what is your relationship and your father's relationship to the story of Sada Shakur?
I bring it up because I'm always fascinated by it. Like, it's part of, her book is part of our history, and it's sort of, it's kind of surreal for me. Also being a writer, like, I'm very creative. So when I read that book, I remember reading her book for the first time when I was in college. I went to Hunter College, and I took African American studies. And again, because of, like you mentioned, COINTELPRO, there was fear. I grew up kind of afraid to really talk about my father, because I knew that those cases and issues were so serious, and I didn't know if he was considered, if my father or Asada were considered like heroes in other people's eyes. Because again, it was just like when you're a kid and you're growing up with something, you know, it's like, I didn't want to really talk about it. I don't know. That was just my view, because again, my mom would collect all the like articles and everything. And she had this like room where she just had all of that information, but she kind of kept it separate from me. And so when I would see it, it was like, oh, like, imagine a child like reading a newspaper and seeing your parents, you know, family members in them. So it was when I went to college that I finally found my community. I was accepted by my college friends. They were like, because they say, how come you never shared this part of your life with us? So
what is the relationship between your father and Sada Shakur?
So when they had a case together, they have a daughter together, which is my sister, Kukuya. So that time for them was, I guess, the most normal, considering this what they were facing. So Asada was also like close to my mom. You know, they were all comrades. So, you know, my mom also became Kukuya's second mother under the circumstances that Asada was facing.
What exactly are the charges against your father, and where is his case at right now?
Okay, so because there's a lot of stuff in between. So again, my dad came home in 1979, and he became he worked for the phone company. He went back to school. He lived in Brooklyn. We lived in Brooklyn. Again, we had like these normal lives, so-called normal. And in 2002, I remember getting a call. Like, I have a family, my, you know, kids, whatever. And at the time, my children's dad, when I came home from work, he told me, he said, I really need you to sit down because I have something to tell you. And it's going to be devastating. And he told me, he's like, your father's been arrested again. And I was just like, what do you mean? Because I didn't even think, after him being home for so many years, from 79 to 2002, really reestablishing himself in, you know, in New York, whatever, that they brought up a charge from 1971, a murder case, and the fact for not agreeing to bring Asada back to this country. He refused. And so they gave him a life sentence plus 10. And so that to me felt like death when I heard that news. And I was just going through that process again, because I went through seeing him in New York, and then because that case was in Atlanta, and then being taken to Atlanta. And so I was like numb for so long, many years, even when there were people advocating during his trial while he was in Atlanta. I couldn't even comprehend the fact that this nightmare happened again. And then I was given the opportunity with my children and my mom. We took a road trip to Atlanta one year. And when we got to the prison, we had filled out all the paperwork for my kids and my mom, but they decided that they weren't going to let anyone in but me. And so my kids, my mother was just like, what, you know? But that somehow, that visit gave me this incredible amount of strength
because I was able to really sit with my father for the first time in years again to really be clear and what his needs are. And that was the beginning of me really, really understanding, like, okay, I have to be my father's voice. And from then, that time, I would, you know, continue to visit him in Atlanta. But again, because he's at Augusta State Medical Prison, which is horrible prison, he went in with some illnesses. He had hepatitis and this illness called sarcoidosis. But because of my father is a devoted Muslim and vegan, he, you know, in terms of his eating habits and everything, he was able to manage his health. But his health started deteriorating more there because he had gotten these, like, not ulcers, but these wounds on the side of his, both his ankles. And then they started expanding. And he didn't receive the treatment. There were many times where he had gotten these horrible wounds and gotten infected. I almost lost him a few times. And then that's when we really realized we need a campaign for my father, you know, medical, legal team. We need to do something more than just, what is it, you know, making calls. We really need people to understand, like, who he is and stuff, so, and support him.
So what is it that people listening to this interview, what is it that they can do for Black Panther political prisoner, Black Liberation Army political prisoner, Kamal Siddiqui?
I would say folks need to be educated. You know, I think it's beyond just, like, supporting someone, but really understanding who the person is. And I want one thing, go on our website, freekamalsiddiqui.com, and it gives you more, you know, background, probably missing some of the details that I've shared. But we're in the process, again, of his parole packet, where we've reached out to numerous elected officials and putting letters together in support of him, just from different communities, the folks that know him, folks that have heard of him, to write letters, you know, and just on the Free Kamal Siddiqui camp for him, for his campaign. And, you know, just to spread the word out. Again, he's one of those quiet warriors, like, that a lot of people haven't heard of, or they, of course, know of Assata Shakur, but, you know, yeah, they don't know about Kamal. So he's coming home, you know, I claim that. So I always say, when you come back home, what do you need? Like, we're getting housing in place for him. You need resources. There's always resources, you know, programs to, you know, to go back to school. And I'm trying to build and have a fundraising for him just so he can have enough funds so when he comes home.
That was Kasese Siddiqui, daughter of political prisoner Kamal Siddiqui, speaking to J.R. Valray of Block Report Radio. Kasese will be performing at the Curb Fest for Political Prisoners in Houston, Texas on October 26. Learn more about Kamal Siddiqui. Visit freekamau.com.
American Carelessness.
My name is Assata Shakur.
Subjected to the dehumanizing power of exploitation and racism for hundreds of years.
Based on their false accusations against me, any police officer could shoot me on sight. National and local police agencies created the situation.
If you believe in human rights, then you have to believe in the liberation of all.
American Carelessness.
I receive no justice.
And in spite of the fact that they were completely suppressed in a physical sense, their demeanor when they entered the courtroom, that they were not for a moment going to resign themselves to that situation.
Only reflect that the racist attitude of the general power structure, and I have received a fair trial.
American Carelessness.
This kind of thing has to not only be exposed, but has to be answered.
And in order to achieve, they'd have to be twice as good as white.
That was Terry Lynn Carrington, Social Science, No Justice for Political Prisoners, featuring Michelle Indigocello. This is Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm your host, Akua Holt. On September 10, 2024, the Pennsylvania Superior Court rejected Mumia Abu-Jamal's petition for relief in the first-degree murder charges against him. The court upheld a decision by Philadelphia Common Pleas Judge Lucretia Clemens to deny any evidentiary hearing despite the discovery of new evidence in 2021. This evidence found in the district attorney's office included a note from a key witness demanding money from the prosecution and notes revealing racial bias in jury selection. The Superior Court acknowledged that the evidence should have been disclosed, but ruled that it did not affect the outcome of the case. Abu-Jamal was convicted 43 years ago for the murder of a Philadelphia police officer. Mumia and his supporters continue to maintain his innocence. They have fought for justice for Mumia for decades and have asked for a fair trial. J.R. Valray spoke to Jamal Ibn Mumia, the son of political prisoner and prolific journalist Mumia Abu-Jamal.
I am Jamal Ibn Mumia, his oldest son. And when you have your father actually snatched away at the age of 9, and there's no physical contact till you are at least to the age of 39 or 40, because he'd been on death row for 30 years, right? So there's a lot of things that you look at and you're wondering about the system. And just by him fighting for his life, always standing on his innocence, always claiming his innocence, and it's just been a struggle, because people forget the perspective of his humanity, that he was actually a journalist before he was incarcerated. He was actually a father before he was incarcerated. He was actually like an uncle, and all these things that he actually did disrupted during this period. So it's been very complex to get that part out to the people, instead of what the media and people put out as convicted cop killer or these, you know, ad hominem attacks.
When you talk about his humanity and you look at the image of Mumia that has been built in the media, from the mainstream media, but even from the left-wing media, what are your thoughts when you don't see, or, you know, when people don't get to see the behind-the-scenes human person? What kind of things cross your mind?
A lot of things cross my mind. One of the things is being misinformed, and disinformation comes from the media. Right. And a lot of times people don't do the research, don't do the work. So they really don't get to understand the person. Of course, he's done a lot of things during his incarceration and he's accomplished a lot of goals. But if we can just take one moment and look at what would he have been doing and what magnitude he'd be at had he been still out here in the free world. And, you know, when you look at his case, you look at all them different things going around in his case, like, you know, currently they had the thing with the boxes that was found magically in the district attorney's closet at their office that was moved from Arch Street to another street. It's like all these boxes of evidence with his name on it. And they was like, oh, yeah, they wasn't turned over to the defense because they were misplaced and they was this and that. So there's a lot of things, things like the original officer, you know, that was on the scene. I'm talking about, when I say original officer, I'm talking about the one that was Alfonso Giordano, which was the Philadelphia police inspector that architected the frame up at the scene. You know, people don't see these things because they forget. They just go with what the media is showing. We have to, at this time of information that we have to do the research. We have to ask the questions and stand on why this happened. What's happening with this? Why there ain't nobody talking about this? Where's this person at? What happened with this person? You know, we had things like even Arnold Beverly when he, you know, did a confession. Nobody's talking about that.
Who is Arnold Beverly? Remind the people real quick.
Okay, Arnold Beverly was a self-described hitman who in 1999, he confessed to doing the murder of police officer Falk. Nobody did nothing about that. They said basically like, oh, okay, the courts ain't going to allow it because it's time barred or something like that. Or it was something like never got to no light. But to me, no rock should be unturned. And people is getting blinded by the media saying cop killer or this and that or another MOVE supporter or MOMIA supporter. They throw these words up there to trigger people or to just have people wag the dog tail. You know, look over here. Right. This is shiny. Nothing to see over here, though, what's going on. Right. These are the things that bothers me because now my father has great-grandchildren because I have grandchildren. And they go to visit him, and they ask tough questions, you know? Like, why are you not home, Grandpa? Why they still got you here, you know? So my thing is, what's the cover-up? The cover-up is all those dirty people that have been involved to put my father in this position. And that is a position of incarceration and slow death row. Because to me, life imprisonment is no different than death row. You know, I don't care how they sugarcoat it and one of the lesser evils. My thing is, how could you be removed off of death row after 30 years after Judge Yon sees something that was unconstitutional? I ain't the smartest person in the world, but if something is unconstitutional, then the whole case should have been reversed.
Right.
How is this is not looked at this time? So you're not good for death row, but we're going to put you in life right now. And then we're going to spin it and say, oh, the prosecution got a chance to answer. These are game thematics. Why these are not being contested? How is this even possible in the day and time that we live in that as social media, people that can get the internet, people that can review these things, you know, fact check or whatever they want to do and see who is Arnold Beverly, see who is Alfonso Giordano, you know, which was a corrupted police officer inspector, you know, that got arrested later on and helped the feds. Because 1987, 88, the late 80s, all of a sudden, the whole police district down there from the 6th precinct, downtown Philly, they got like 20-something, 11, 12, 20 cops all locked up for corruption. How this case ain't overturned? This is like insanity. You know what I mean? Because now it's been over 40 years, right? My father's still incarcerated. I wasn't seeing him. 2 weeks back, just passed. And, you know, he trying to work on his health, trying to get himself together. But I'm like, man, we need you out of here. He said, son, I want to come home. I said, I know you want to come home. But these are the things people are not seeing. Right. You know, man is still standing on his innocence. And it's just like, just to give you a background on, I know I said some names. Alfonso Giordano is a Philadelphia police inspector, right, that architected the frame up at the scene. And Giordano, not only a dirty cop, but a favorite of the brutal and racist police commissioner and late Mayor Frank Rizzo, commander of the police department SWAT team, conducted the raids on the Black Panther Party in the late 60s when Mumia was a well-known spokesman. Giordano, also in charge of the year-long police siege of the MOVE organization home from 1977 to 1978, ending with police attack on MOVE supporters, including children in the house, and led to 30 and 100 years sentences of the MOVE 9. Mumia publicly challenged Rizzo and DA Ed Rendell about the raid and the brutality and the arrest. Giordano was at the scene 3 minutes after the first radio call for backup from Faulkner. He found Mumia already thrown into a paddy wagon, shot and critically wounded and beaten by the police. Giordano knew exactly who Mumia was. Giordano's first act was to further assault Mumia, hitting him in the head with his baton, hurling racial slurs, and Giordano set up the false witness IDs from the cab driver Chobert and Cynthia White. His lying report that Mumia confessed was featured in the news. Giordano was the police witness in the pretrial proceedings. Judge Sable ruled that Giordano could testify at Mumia's trial about his false confession. Then, without explanation, Giordano did not testify. Instead, the prosecution dropped notice of the hospital confession reported 2 months after the shooting. The why behind Giordano's absence from the trial and the fabrication of Mumia's hospital confession is explained by the fact that December 1981, when Faulkner was murdered, Giordano was a target of ongoing federal investigations into Philadelphia police corruption. including collaboration with organized crime and gambling, prostitution, and drug dealing. Proof from court records of those prosecutions and affidavits of the key FBI confidential informants, Donald Herson, May 1999, his federal trial testimony led to some 30 cop convictions. Targets included James Colaney, head of the Police Homicide Division, John D. Benedetto, head of the Central Division where Faulkner was assigned, as well as Inspector Giordano. This was the police chain of command and the frame-up prosecution of Mumia. In February 1982, Giordano was removed from his inspector command post and transferred to a desk job in the Police Personnel Division. This was the same time as the prosecution's roundtable meeting with police witnesses and the dates of new and false police reports of Mumia's hospital confession. Then, on the first working day after Mumia was convicted and sentenced to death on July 5, 1982, Giordano retired from the police force at full pay, documented by police personnel records. D. Benedetto and other Central Division police officers were convicted on corruption charges and served prison terms. Giordano got a plea deal a few years later. No prison, a modest fine, right? Mm-hmm. That's the background of the of Alfonso Giordano.
Where'd you read that from?
Well, one of the things that I've got this from, you can go on through the cases. If you look into Mumia's cases, there is different websites you can look at. And one of the websites that I looked at was the PDC, which is the Partisan Defense Committee. They still got them posted where you can see the affidavits and all these people that I named in there, and you can read them for yourself. These are affidavits from live people. But what I did was I put it together.
You gave the people a lot to chew on. I mean, you read straight from the affidavits.
I want them to do their research. I want them to go online. Like I said, these are human beings that did these statements. There's stuff you can find on the Partisan Defense Committee, PDC, websites. And you can look for affidavits. But my thing is, JR, we had a time at social media, internet, that we just can't be just going for any narrative that they give us. You know what I mean?
Right.
That was Jamal Ibn Mumia, son of internationally renowned journalist, humanitarian, author, host, and producer Mumia Abu-Jamal, speaking to JR Valray of Block Report Radio.
Imagine living, eating, sleeping, relieving oneself, daydreaming, weeping, but mostly waiting in the room the size of your bathroom. Now imagine doing all those things, but mostly waiting for the rest of your life. Imagine waiting, waiting, waiting to die. I don't have to imagine. I live in one of those rooms, like about 3,000 other men and women in 38 states across the United States. It's called death row. I call it hell. Welcome to hell. Each of the states which have death rows have a different system for their execution cases, varying from the relatively open to the severely restrictive. Some states, like California and Texas, allow their execution cases work, education, and or religious service opportunities for out-of-cell time up to 8 hours a day. Pennsylvania locks its execution cases down 23 hours a day, 5 days a week, 24 hours the other 2 days. At the risk of quoting Mephistopheles, I repeat, welcome to hell.
You've just heard Spoken Word by Mumia Abu-Jamal. Mimi Rosenberg, host of WBAI's Equal Rights and Justice, spoke to scholar activist Dr. Gerald Horn about his new book, Armed Struggle, Panthers and Communists, Black Nationalists and Liberals in Southern California through the 60s and 70s, which examines the Black Panther Party's legacy. The book also draws on Horn's own experience in Berkeley in the 70s. Dr. Horn is a professor of history and African American studies at the University of Houston and author of many books.
For me, the 60s and 70s period of the upsurge of organizations like the Black Panther Party which seemed to meld the practice of working with the masses, providing them with a service, and political education to really look towards the assumption of state power, and an organization that was informed by, throughout the world at that period, anti-colonialist struggles that gave instruction to educate, agitate, and to organize here as part of the liberation struggle. And the liberation struggle, I think the Panthers understood, was against capitalism. I'm wondering if that is what provoked or evoked for you this particular period of study and to unearth and to bring to us in your work, Armed Struggle. What was it that you thought was so strategic about this period and groups like the Black Panther Party? And they are by no means the only organization from the liberatory process that you study in this opus, Armed Struggle.
Well, you may recall that I moved to the San Francisco Bay Area some decades ago in order to attend law school, and I became involved with the Black Panther Party and became involved with many folks who were oriented within their orbit. For example, I taught at a so-called correctional facility in the Golden State in Vacaville, just north of Berkeley, where I was enrolled in school. And one of my students was a man then known as Donald DeFries, who you may recall.
Yes.
Ultimately went up in flames after he became involved in a shootout with the LAPD some years ago as a result of his affiliation with the so-called Symbionese Liberation Army. And in fact, I had lent him my prized copy of Frederick Engels, The Origin of the Family Private Property in the State, which I never got back, needless to say, which was a cautionary note in terms of lending out books. So this particular book we have before us is not only a product of research, but it also has a kind of memoir embedded in it, since I was involved, albeit peripherally, in some of the activities that I write about. This book not only deals with the Panthers in Southern California from about the mid-1960s through the late 1970s, it also deals with the Southern California Communist Party from the time of the Bolshevik Revolution of 1917 over that same time period. And I should say, parenthetically, that it deals with the NAACP during that same particular period, because they were a kind of counterpoint to those two previously aforementioned organizations, not to mention dealing with various other trends of Black nationalism, not least the US organization led by a man still in the land of the living, speaking of Malana Karenga, perhaps best known to your audience as a person who helped to devise the celebration, if you like, in late December of every year, early January, of Kwanzaa. I should say that this book also tries to reframe this concept of Black power, because oftentimes, if you look at the current histories of, quote, Black power, unquote, you'll find that certain antagonists are basically grouped together, which would have been rather disappointing to both sides, going back to their origins. What I'm talking about is that you may know that in this book, there is a pivotal turning point in 1969 when there's a shootout on the UCLA campus between the Panthers and certain members of the US organization. Now, some in your audience might find it curious that those folks who were shooting at each other are basically grouped together. And as an earlier comment by yourself suggests, the Panthers were deeply influenced by the science of society, by socialism, by communism. Jonathan Jackson, who is a leading figure in this book, recalled that it was in August 1970 that this precocious teenager with roots in Pasadena entered a courthouse in Marin County, California, north of San Francisco, and helped to liberate a number of prisoners who were then on trial. But in a subsequent shootout, he and a couple of prisoners, in addition to the judge, were killed. Now, Jonathan Jackson, as a high schooler, edited a newspaper called Iskra, homage to a publication of the same name that was published by Bolsheviks in Russia. The Panthers were quite taken with the Marxist Russian philosopher Plekhanov. Now, many of the historians who are writing about the Panthers today are not necessarily familiar with Plekhanov, not necessarily familiar with Iskra. Perhaps this is not just a matter of not being aware of certain philosophical discourses, but perhaps it's also a reflection of the Cold War. That is to say, since the collapse of the Soviet Union, there has been a kind of ideological victory or advance, if you like, by imperialists, which has tended to obscure, if not obliterate, some of the advances and some of the discourses that the Panthers and other black radicals and black revolutionaries were involved in. What I'm seeking to do is restore a more accurate picture of what went down, because as we face, according to some, the hot breath of fascism breathing down our necks, the fact that a member of the Heritage Foundation, with regard to this so-called Project 2025 that's been put out, suggested that it was a bloodless, quote, unquote, revolution that was being planned, if the left would allow it to be so, he says. And what I'm trying to do in this book is tell an accurate and comprehensive story about this question of armed struggle, and also what to avoid if we have to go down that road in the future because of this hot breath of fascism breathing down our necks.
That was attorney Mimi Rosenberg, host of WBAI's Equal Rights and Justice, and Dr. Gerald Horn, author of Armed Struggle, Panthers and Communists, Black Nationalists and Liberals in Southern California through the 60s and 70s. And that concludes today's edition of Capitalism, Race and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. Today's program was produced by me, Akua Holt, and the Capitalism, Race, and Democracy Collective, with contributions from J.R. Bell Ray, Akichi Taifa, and Mimi Rosenberg, with editing and production support from Paulina Basilia. You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, capitalismraceanddemocracy.org. Make sure you click the subscribe button. Follow us on X, formerly Twitter, at PacificaCRD. I've been your host, Akua Holt. Thanks for listening. Before we go, I leave you with this quote. Those who say it can't be done are usually interrupted by others doing it. James Baldwin.